Ja, hallo, hier ist Felicia Herrschaft, heute mit einer Sendung mit Drusilla Cornell. Ein Gespräch, das wir führen, und zwar versuchen wir, die Gerechtigkeitskonzepte von Derrida und Rawls zu vergleichen und dies eben auf die aktuellen Einschränkungen des öffentlichen Raums und der demokratischen Kultur in Amerika zu beziehen. Die Bedingungen öffentlicher Kultur und imaginärer Räume muss neu bestimmt werden, indem man die Verbindung zwischen Politik und Ästhetik überdenkt. Drusilla Cornell spricht außerdem über Rassismus, den sie in den USA erfährt, mit ihrer Tochter, mit ihrer Multicultural Family und über ihre Arbeit in Südafrika. Sie ist bekannt, Drusilla Cornell ist bekannt für ihre Arbeiten zur Rechtsphilosophie als auch zur feministischen Philosophie. Und sie hat zum Beispiel die ersten Konferenzen in den 90ern mit Derrida organisiert, die Benjamin Cardozo School of Law, an der sozusagen Derrida dann seinen philosophischen Turn, also in eine mehr ethische Dimension gebracht hat. Sie vergleicht demnach jetzt gleich die Konzepte von Rawls und Derrida. Das heißt, was bedeutet Doing Justice bei Derrida und wie bestimmen Menschen ihre jeweiligen politischen Interessen? Das hier war jetzt gerade Wilfred Chavez. Und die Texas Band, das ist Zydeco gewesen. Let's go to Lafayette. In dem Sinne, Wilfred Chavez ist ein Blues- und Zydeco-Musiker aus Louisiana, der aber schon sehr lange in Houston arbeitet und im Big Easy, im House of Mixology, auftritt. So, und jetzt aber direkt das Interview mit Drusilla Cornell.
We are reading The Force of Law from Derrida. What is the relation, because you had this lecture on Rawls, The Law of the People, so, and Derrida's critique on The Force of Law is really a critique on Kritik der Gewalt from Benjamin, and where's the relation between the both laws?
How do I put it together, in other words?
How would you put
this
together?
This has a lot to do with how I read Derrida's famous statement, deconstruction is justice.
Yeah.
And so let me kind of move through that, which is that what I interpret Derrida to mean by that is, first of all, he's taking himself very seriously on that point. Deconstruction is justice in that it keeps open the demand on us at every moment to be just. Yeah. So he is returning the notion of justice as a relationship, which he sees as implicit in a kind of common sense notion of doing justice, of being just.
Yeah.
So that if you want to get very popular, think of Clint Eastwood's movies, in which Clint Eastwood is always trying to do justice, at the same time be a just man.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, Derrida's actually working off that notion, one that we've lost. of being just, doing justice as something that is a natural relationship and a demand on us now.
Yeah.
Now that's why for Derrida, justice is not reducible to a horizon, like in an ideal sense, like Kant.
Yeah.
Because it's a demand that I be just and do justice to you.
Yeah.
Now at the same time, Derrida realizes that being just and doing justice to you has to proceed through some kind of field of significance that you and I can both understand.
Yeah.
And that field of significance is law, some of the time.
Yeah.
Not all of the time, but some of the time. And since the force of law is talking about law, Derrida's also saying that part of being just and doing justice is actually making that field of significance as close to justice as possible, as it's actually being articulated as a set of ideals. So although people read when Derrida says it's irreducible to horizon, they oftentimes read him as dismissing the ideal. No, that's not at all what he's doing. It's that being just and doing justice in an actual legal system is going to involve you in interpreting and, if you will, bringing into material existence that demand on you through a reinterpretation of the law.
Yeah.
So in the Philosophy of the Limit, for example, I use Justice Blackmun in his famous Roe v. Wade decision as an example of someone who, as a judge, feels a demand, be just to women, do justice for women, and give them the right to abortion. Because what is the demand there of be just is to give a law that grants a right to women.
Yeah.
The time within law, Blackmun didn't have the jurisprudential resources to do that.
Yeah.
You can't be equality. Men don't get pregnant under U.S. jurisprudence at that time. It can't be freedom because it's a right to.
Yeah.
And our notion of freedom in U.S. jurisprudence is negative.
Yeah.
You know, no one can interfere. But now abortion, you have to go to the hospital. You have to see a doctor. We don't have any ability to make jurisprudential sense of the right to. In other countries and under constitutions, you do. So Derrida's actually, my interpretation of his work showing us in the force of law is coming back to that very old but formidable sense, be just, do justice.
Yeah.
When you are working within a legal system, and say you're a judge, that's going to be giving the interpretation of law that brings you closest to justice.
Yeah.
So in that way, yes, Blackmun is going to proceed through the ideals of freedom, through the ideals of equality, which in our own jurisprudence, he ultimately ends up not using. So for me, this is a classic example of a judge saying, I must do justice even when the law can't signify it for me. But part of the work that I tried to show, if you read Derrida on all his richness and complexity, is that be just to justice, be just, do justice to the other, will demand that you actually take responsibility for the nomos, the common signifiers of ideality within your own legal system.
Yes.
So once we have that background, and that's a very different way of thinking, for example, than readers of deconstruction, who I think have misunderstood that particular essay as if saying, well, justice just generates aporias, so therefore there is no work of justice. No, not at all. The work of justice has to proceed on the level in a legal system of you interpreting the ideals within the legal system. And if you have a jurisprudential lack or inability to meet certain ideals, to reinterpret what those ideals might mean. So there's actually a call upon a judge, a call upon a lawyer to take responsibility for their that nomos and to make it just. So it's nor is Derrida then saying, well, law and justice are always separable. No. You see, at any minute, of course, there's a common sense way, and that is what he's saying. I have to be just. I have to do you justice. Mm-hmm. I have to bring the legal system as close as I can to delivering justice to you.
Yeah.
And so, yes, it's an aporia that if I do that through a roar, I haven't decided.
Yeah.
Because in order to do justice, I have to decide what is just at every moment. But I do this through this signifier. So there's layers and layers and layers in which Derrida's giving us a call to responsibility to always make our legal system as close to justice as possible. Now, once you read it this way, and I think this is actually one of the richest texts we have, kind of a deep thinking about, but what's very, that's, like I said, it's in Clint Eastwood movies. Clint Eastwood's always trying to do justice and be just to the other. And getting all angry with the law because it doesn't allow it, is that you can see that he's not saying that there's no need, no demand to work within a legal system, that you just say all ideals are equal, there's no way of judging that. That is exactly what he isn't saying. The command on you to judge is never going to be one that you can rest after you've said, oh, well, I interpret, for instance, the right of abortion through the ideal of bodily integrity, which is how I defend it.
Yeah.
Yes, I'm called to do that. I must do that work. But that work itself will never simply be justice.
Yeah.
So the way I tried to correct for misunderstandings is that this is a call to responsibility for those of us who work in a legal system to work with those ideals. And this takes me to Rawls then. Rawls, in a sense, is the greatest thinker of the ideals, and it's a very American, quote-unquote, thinker in the end, and that may have been his significant limitation.
Yeah.
But to work within the ideals of U.S. constitutionalism, what he called U.S. constitutional essentials. But also within international law, the way I used Rawls is that, again, he's using a hypothetical experiment in the imagination to help us lay out the field of significance of our ideality in which we might begin to shape what peoples could do if they were able to come out of the state of nature.
Yeah.
Now, I see nothing incompatible with deconstruction as justice and those kinds of hypothetical experiments of the imagination if they are understood as aesthetic ideas and only as aesthetic ideas.
Aesthetic ideas.
Yes. There's nothing in deconstruction that says that we don't have to lay out this field of ideality. Instead, I'm saying it's a demand on us. But it does mean that we no longer claim any kind of strong metaphysical ground for those aesthetic ideas. They are experiments in the imagination. And Derrida always hesitated before saying much about the imagination.
Yeah.
But in places in his last writing, he was clearly aware of what he called negotiations, which is how does one actually materialize, work through this relational demand, be just to justice, be just, do justice to the other, so that it comes to be for us, so we have to negotiate. The Law of the Peoples, for me, is a brilliant experiment in the imagination in which Rawls is engaging in that kind of negotiation. Rawls, of course, would never put it that way.
Yeah.
But Rawls, towards the end of his life, does start to realize that the veil of ignorance is just a representational device, a great metaphor, if you will. So in a sense, part of my work has been to show the thinkers who seem so different, once we really read them in a different field of significance, and we always remember the most profound lesson of deconstruction, which is you don't rest with any aesthetic idea.
Yeah.
It may be the best configuration you can give of the demand of justice within international law or human rights or within a constitution to give women a seemingly incomprehensible right to bodily integrity. But you know, since it's an aesthetic idea, that there will always be more demands on you put by that other, because that other is something you can never imagine in all their demand on you in advance.
Yeah. That's right. And what has this to do with the structural change and transformation of the public sphere in relation to what is Rawls could say on the field of negotiation, is and Derrida's doing justice. How is it possible, or how would you say is the public sphere in a transformation process, getting more reflexive because of these two dimensions? Probably, is there Is that a kind of transcending the horizon if you have a really structural and reflexive public sphere?
Let's start again with Derrida and this very rich notion of negotiations. Again, I think so much of Jacques' last years and last 10 years was spent thinking about materializing this demand or the other, right? What Levinas calls a demand for some kind of third to signify.
Yeah.
Be just, do justice. Negotiations is definitely about, for Derrida, keeping alive a reflective, self-reflective public sphere.
Yeah.
And so the command that I've told you, that deconstruction, if it was misread, and I really, 1992, when I wrote The Philosophy of the Limit,
yeah,
this was a very controversial point that I made. I think Derrida's sense has been very clear where he stands, as he stands as he sees it too.
Yeah.
Deconstruction is justice. It's a demand on you for infinite responsibility to the other. And that means that you have to negotiate, because you have to make a public sphere. You have to make a debate. Debates taking place in France on gay and lesbian marriage.
Yeah.
It's not true that each position is equally as good. No, that's Derrida definitely wanted to clear away that misunderstanding of deconstruction.
Oh.
You know, that it literally undermined all basis of either determinant judgment and consensus or practical judgment. Not at all. We have to negotiate. The ideality we understand as aesthetic ideas, we have to put it to play in a field which materializes through the signifiers we give it, you know. So say, you say, gays and lesbians have the right to get married, as I would defend it, through the imaginary domain. An idea that Derrida found very compatible to him, the imaginary domain. So I say gays and lesbians have the right to get married through the imaginary domain. The imaginary domain is the moral and psychic space we must have. At that moment, the imaginary domain is operating to open up the public sphere in two senses. One, it's a psychic and moral space that has to be there. It demands self-reflection in a sense. For instance, I'm homophobic and I never want to sit next to a gay couple in a restaurant. Well, if they have to be granted that right because they have the right to express who they are sexually and I have the right to have that same right, that's Kant's negative freedom as an internal relationship against each other, I have to reflect on my homophobia. This, I have to live in a society in which I don't get to say I'm offended by gay people and my offense is going to govern.
Yeah.
No, I have to reflect. There's a way in which there's an imaginary public space that's already there in the tension that the defense of the right of the imaginary domain demands. It keeps people from getting themselves off the hook because they're offended.
Yeah.
And then the second way, and this is what Derrida, I think, really was very serious about negotiations, it opens up by materializing signifiers, you know, an actual space of debate. In other words, a public sphere for us can never just be literalized. I do think we need churches. God only knows we need bookstores, and we're losing those kinds of public spaces, you know, to advance capitalism in New York City. But we also need the kind of what we're talking about here, almost like an imaginary, critical, self-reflective space that's with us everywhere two people sit down.
Yeah.
And this is what I think Derrida was really very much about in negotiations.
Mm.
So we're always trying to materialize, to use fancy words for a minute, the signifiers that give meaning to our debate.
Yeah.
You know, are you for gay or lesbian marriage? You know, came out very strongly for gay and lesbian civil unions in France. Are you for the people who are holding out places to live for those who are sans papier, you know, without papers?
Yeah.
Who were, Derrida said, committing the crime of hospitality.
Derrida
came out and said, there can be no crime of hospitality. And then he's working that ideal of hospitality.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, so, and by so doing, he's trying to open up the, exactly like I gave the example of the imaginary domain, what does it mean to be hospitable to the other, you know, in France now, you know, to someone who doesn't have papers? What's your responsibility to that person? So, but he was doing it by actually putting into play, you know, the crime of hospitality, the taking that word hospitality and reworking its meaning, in a sense, is an ideal.
And but the next step is, and this is, I think, another dimension in the way he describes or the ability to accept that the other would not excuse torture or in relation to the truth commissions mm-hmm. in South Africa.
Right.
What has this to do? Because doing justice is something else than having the possibility or this potentiality approach of saying we don't excuse sex, das Verzeihen. Also,
well, it's very complicated. I've been actually working for the last several years on a project called the Ubuntu Project in South Africa.
Yeah.
There's layers and layers in which. But it's not simply a matter of we don't excuse. As you know, one of the most controversial things that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission did is they gave amnesty.
Yeah.
So it did excuse.
Yeah.
You know, if you came forward and you committed, that you committed these horrific crimes against humanity, you were given amnesty. And so here, Derrida, in his work on forgiveness, is talking about two things, right? Yeah. Is that the demand on South Africa in constituting itself as a new nation, in a sense, was to do the impossible, to forgive on both sides acts that any one of us would find so horrific that there's no way to do justice to it. But how can you do justice to a mother whose son was tortured, murdered, and then put on a stewing, whatever that's called, and burnt as a pig? And yes, they went out and she wanted her son's bones back, and the man who murdered and tortured her son had to dig up her son's bones and give them back to her. And it's a beautiful, dramatic example of the impossibility of justice at that moment, and yet the demand, do what you can to be with me in this impossible situation in which I'm being asked to forgive you. And this woman actually did forgive him, and I actually, you know, have met over and over again people in South Africa who clearly have this capacity to do the impossible that I don't think I have. I would like to work for it, but I do not have it.
Yeah.
And so Derrida is talking here about when amnesty was granted, there's a sense in which justice could no longer be.
Yeah.
You know, but the demand of the specter, the demand that was haunting South Africa, was to admit that things had been done for which there was no reparation, not even revenge.
Mm.
Nothing can make it right. So be justice, do justice collapses here.
Yeah.
And although I agree with Mahmoud Mamdani, there's no reconciliation in the end without justice, there's also has to be these horrible moments where there is no justice possible. And yet, something else, some other relationality through the work of that impossibility, which Derrida beautifully calls forgiveness, has to be at work there.
Yeah.
If there is to be something, if not reconciliation as an achievement, but reconciliation as an endless process of admitting that before certain horrific crimes committed on both sides, because it wasn't just white Afrikaners who were given amnesty. ANC members were also given amnesty for engaging in things like necklacing, just burning somebody alive, sometimes mistakenly thinking someone was an informer.
Yeah.
So again, how do you say to the mother of the son or the daughter who was necklaced, here are the bones of your dead child. We thought this individual was an informant. There's no any way of making that right. And so what fascinated Derrida about South Africa is the moving within that impossibility. Because so amnesty becomes a form of excuse, but one that demands that everyone recognize, and this is what Ubuntu is about, that the shared humanity of South Africans had been physically almost drained, because Ubuntu has this physicality to it, drained out of people.
Yeah.
And so the movement of restoration could not be brought about by revenge or any of our traditional notions of doing justice. So you have to then work the impossibility of that to find some way to forgive.
Yeah.
And that's what Derrida says. It's a beautiful tragic, horrifying, overwhelming example of people being asked in the name of something to be newly constituted, the new South Africa, to do the impossible.
There should come roles into the play, probably.
And but you see, what I was earlier on, I said Rawls was a very American thinker, and getting back to your public sphere question, he was very American in a good way. He was terrified about the future of the United States towards the end of his life.
Yeah.
The last conference on his work before he became ill, he actually questioned whether, you know, democracy was going to be safe in the United States. And he was honest enough in The Laws of the People to point out to the problem. He never used the word capitalism, but he called it oligarchy. You know, oligarchic financial interests dominating the United States. And taking the United States into a position of seeking what we would call hegemonic power. That was very much on Rawls's mind.
Yes.
So he was frightened by the specter of the United States and noncompliance, and of course he did live to see what we've seen in the last 4 years, the horrific and hubris of the United States before international law. But let's say he saw it coming.
Yeah.
And think about it, the Law of the People dares to create at the level of the imagination, a reasonable Muslim people.
Mm.
And then you have Mandami's book, Good Muslim, Bad Muslim, and here's Rawls demanding, because this is a book written for Americans, demanding that they face, that they can't really even imagine that reasonable Muslim people. But of course, we should be able to imagine it, and they can be law-abiding citizens before international law the way we can.
Yeah.
The other thing that he feared was the religious right in this country. And that's why he became so, some would say, anti a certain kind of politics with his notion of public reason.
Yeah.
No, he did not want people to get up and say, I am against the right of abortion because Jesus Christ was by my bed last night and he said any woman who has an abortion is a sinner. Rawls didn't want that kind of argument.
Yeah.
We are having that kind of argument in the Congress of the United States. Rawls wanted somebody to say, no, when we're talking about abortion, we're talking about constitutional essentials, like the First Amendment, with its right to bodily integrity, with its right to due process. We want to talk that way.
Yeah.
Because I can't tell you whether Jesus was standing by your bed last night or not, and you can't tell me that Jesus was. So, you know, you and I can't talk then, you know. So there has to be a way to talk to each other. So Rawls became obsessed with that. You have your general comprehensive worldview, it's Muslim. I have mine. I'm actually very involved in African spirituality. Someone else is an atheist. But there should be a way that you and I can debate something like abortion without having to appeal to something that's completely unshareable.
Yeah.
And he saw that. And if you look at the last election, you see exactly what Rawls was scared about.
Yeah.
So when people said, oh, Rawls is a liberalism of fear, yeah, he was a liberalism of fear. He was very frightened of the oligarchic financial interest in the United States. He was very frightened of the religious right in the United States, who, you know, won a politics of revelation based on their given truth, which for him is as scary as Stalinism. So there's a way in which, once you understand Rawls in that sense, that he's prophetic in both ways. He saw the religious crusading, there is no such thing as a good Muslim, grabbing hold of the U.S. populace, and he saw the ability of oligarchic financial interests to appeal to, out of fear, to people's need for some sort of sense of revealed truth, and so that the political argument becomes bogged down in things that you and I can't share. You know, I literally cannot tell you that you didn't see Jesus Christ last night. So, you know, then there's no space. Then there's that, and that's what I talked about, the imaginary moment of public space. There's nothing for you and I to talk about.
Yeah.
You say that Jesus Christ said it, and I said, well, I wasn't there. I didn't see Jesus Christ. But how can we talk about abortion together? So for Rawls, creating public reason was part of creating that imaginary space.
Yeah.
Now, what I like more in terms of the richness of Derrida's notion of negotiation is it also like Rawls and sees that you've got to get in there, take a position, make judgments, defend your judgments as better or worse. Mm. And you're going to do it within a field of ideality. But you're not going to try, as sometimes Rawls desperately wanted to do. You know, it's almost like build walls. You can say this reason, but not that reason, you know. Yes, there's going to be a bleeding over of general and comprehensive worldviews, fine. But once you see Rawls the way I see Rawls, well, you also see the need to say, well, we need these ideals that you and I maybe can agree that we share.
Yeah.
So that we can talk about these burning issues.
Yeah.
And that is what Derrida would call the demand on me to negotiate, that you and I find some shared language. And the word I used in my public lecture, I see Rawls reaching for something like that in this notion of conjectural reasoning,
yeah,
where you and I work at this, rather than just me coming in and saying, okay, here's the ideal. You're going to put yourself behind the veil of ignorance now, and you're going to do it this way. And the person says, well, I don't want to do it that way. You know, so you know, I'm going to do it through some other imaginative advice, or do it through speaking to my God. But once I've spoken to my God, I'm willing to negotiate with you how we're going to put together a way of thinking about something like gay and lesbian marriage. So conjectural reasoning carries that work between you and me.
Yeah.
You know, as it's not just going to be, and I think when Rawls gets criticized for aestheticizing politics, I think that's way too simple a criticism of him. It's because it seems like, okay, this is a device, this is what you use, this is what I use, this is how you're going to use it. But
yeah,
then you're not risking the negotiation.
Yeah.
And Derrida's saying you have to risk the negotiation. Otherwise, the ideality will freeze and it won't serve
yeah
the work of actually keeping that space of debate open.
Yeah. Yeah, Kyra Holland, she's now working as a job for a politician here in the community, for the 14th Street, for the East Village, and in for every decision they have to make, they have to go as politicians to the community groups and to explain and to fight for what they think is the best way for the community. And this is, I think, a really specific understanding of democracy in America, which is a kind of democracy, which is really democracy we don't know in Germany in that way of how the communities are working in every neighborhood together for the city, for city of New York or for the United States. But she is really afraid now after the election that it's going more and more to fascism, what is going on. The neighborhoods, they are really working in this democratic way, but the politics over it is really more against democracy.
You know, what's very interesting, you said something I think is true of the United States, which is the United States has always had a history of grassroots organizing, a very strong history of grassroots organizing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not just you see it in Vietnam and you see it in the civil rights movement. You see it in the great union movements in this country. I was a union organizer for many, many years. You see it in the populist movements that swept the Midwest in the early 20th century. I mean, we really have that kind of town hall meeting tradition that you're discussing.
Yeah, this veil of ignorance.
And we had it in New York City, where the group I'm part of, Take Back the Future and Defend the Bill of Rights, worked so hard, as many people in the United States did, to have cities actually vote down the USA Patriot Act. This is unheard of. But the idea was that a city could say, we won't follow what we see as an unconstitutional law. And of course, under our federal system, you know, if a federal law is supposed to be applied by every city, so it's cities rebelling against the federal government. And although, unfortunately, New York City has yet to pass that, 27 cities in the United States did. So that's the kind of democratic tradition you're talking about. That's a city council basically rebelling against the way we set up our whole legal system by saying, no, we won't apply federal law. It's unjust. It's unconstitutional.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, I agree with your friend. That is a very proud and powerful and important tradition in the United States. And interestingly enough, it was one that very much impressed Derrida.
Explain how it is working for political philosophy.
He was very impressed with it and very impressed with the way, you know, an organization like Take Back the Future could just go out on the streets without a permit and pass out leaflets attacking the USA Patriot Act, you know, and just say the streets are ours. But the USA Patriot Act is a disaster for that kind of democracy. Mm-hmm. You know, it attacks it at all levels. You know, it, by heightening security, now it hasn't been used that much against U.S. citizens yet, but it can be because it has a very extensive definition of what it means to engage in activities that might undermine our security. And the other part that's happening is we're losing our literal public spaces. New York City used to be filled with bookstores where poets read, where discussions took place, progressive left-wing churches. Many of them have not been able to sustain themselves. So a lot of that kind of local organizing turned on those literal spaces where one of them is still around, Judson Church, which is where Take Back the Future was formed. But the Methodist Church right around the corner from me is now broke. We now have Barnes & Noble. We don't have many of those alternative, what would now be called alternative bookstores. So yeah, the reality that, this notion that Bush has and that Cheney has, where you don't have any form of public support for public space, from public radio to public financing of the arts, makes this kind of day-to-day street democracy harder and harder and harder and harder.
She was part of the discussion of the Frank Gehry building, and they installed now into the Gehry building, after a lot of discussions, a public school. That's really interesting that it's possible really to work on on the new recycling system. They work together on with the community or against the community when they, and I don't know how really to describe this.
But see, the problem, what Cheney's doing is we're bankrupting the federal government, basically. We have a $3 trillion deficit, depending on how you count the numbers. So the cities are in deep trouble, which means the public schools are in deep trouble. So you see, in a certain sense, if you push to privatize everything, this notion of public interest and social choice becomes increasingly undermined. I think that's what your friend is talking about. Now, if you were a rational choice theorist, you would say, in a certain sense, at a certain point, that you can so undermine any notion of a publicly funded public space that everybody's interest becomes so individualized, there isn't any rational social choice for those individuals to make together. And that's the that really undermines this kind of democracy. Because this kind of democracy turns on the notion that you and I share something in common. We want a really good public school for our kids. But once that public school is completely lacking in funds, you can't get pencils, you can't get books, because it isn't being funded. And in this program, No Child Left Behind, one of the horrible things it does is if the kids don't test up to a certain level, they'll shut the school down. So and that's done from the top down. You see, one of the terrible ironies for all the so-called, you know, no big government, it's a big government move to shut the public schools down, as opposed to saying, what we really need to do is this teacher who had 100 students and 60 books and 40 pencils was trying to teach algebra. Well, of course she didn't succeed in teaching algebra. So let's get her the books, let's get her the pencils. Let's keep the community in charge of that school. But no, the federal government, the state government, they come in, they give these standardized tests, the school doesn't do well, and that school can get shut down. That's called so-called holding the teachers responsible.
Yeah.
The teacher can't teach under those conditions.
Yeah.
So you see, the what's really happening with this so-called society of owners, everything is in your own private pocket, you're undermining at the deepest level the notion of those spaces where people have interests in common, because there's a public funded space like a public school where everybody has the same interests. And now, you know, we're going to have voucher systems and all these ways for people to get out of the public schools, and our public schools in New York City, they're just in shambles. they are in shambles.
Yeah.
Because there just isn't enough funding for them. So that's the insidious part. The privatization takes away those public spaces where people share.
Yeah.
And it's very much part of what you're calling the best democratic tradition, that freedom meant coming together, working with the teachers, building a community, and getting a good school together.
Yeah.
Freedom did not mean being able to keep as much money for yourself, so you, maybe your children are now in college, so you don't want to pay taxes to that public school anymore.
Yeah.
No.
No.
And so it always turns on actually believing there's something called a public interest, or if you want to use the modern economic terms, a rational social choice for us to make together. And this whole bankrupting of the public funding of public institutions, which is going on systematically, and the privatization of everything, is going to really hurt those democratic struggles. And it's an interesting question to me. And we can debate it. Many of my friends would say this country is now fascist. Many would say it's moving towards fascism.
Yeah.
It's moving towards something that is fundamentally at its core anti-democratic and breaking down at the level of the federal government our constitutional protections, and at the level of this local struggle, which is where democracy always flourished in the United States, the notion of shared interest.
Yeah.
Is that it's a form of U.S. reaction and right-winged control. I think it's an interesting question whether it's fascist or not. It certainly is the end of democracy and constitutionalism as I have grown up with it.
Yeah.
We are in a serious constitutional crisis, but I'm with your friend. The more serious thing, well, I don't want to say more serious, both are very serious, is this privatization of everything.
Yeah.
And the way it gets formed in the election, why do people vote against their class interests? Well, if you privatize everything, then you undermine the notion of shared interests.
Yeah.
And so you leave a society in a kind of shambles, and now the only place that the Bush administration wants you to go to get your social services is a Christian fundamentalist church.
Hmm.
So you get some money, and you also get your...
A lot of immigrants who come here have found their new existence in this form of privatization. They have their shops, and with their shops and with this kind of economy, they change the city as well. And but if they are then part of a neighborhood and a community and work with their economic power for the community, where's then the difference between this kind of privatization and having this economic power from the immigrants? And New York is always in the state of everybody can become a New Yorker in the way you use that economic power. Where's the difference, or when is it really becoming a dangerous situation in relation in what fascism can be? If you have privatization, okay, in a way, but economic power from immigrants.
But you see, it's not immigrants have no economic power in New York City. I was almost thinking, you know, let me point you out my window.
Right. Yeah.
There are many small stores, maybe 9, within 2 blocks of here, run by immigrants that have gone bankrupt in the last 6 weeks. One, a restaurant run by a Greek immigrant called Gus, who ran a neighborhood restaurant for 23 years and was forced out. Manhattan is owned by a handful of very, 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 very rich landlords.
Yeah.
And so right across the street from me, Alfie and Zico, Italian and Egyptian immigrant, are trying desperately to keep a small restaurant open in New York City. Now, that is the New York City used to be describing. That New York City had rent control as a matter of law. So no new landlord could come in and buy up your place and say your rent was $15,000 yesterday, it's $30,000 today. But they can now. So what's happening, if you look at my neighborhood, we have Duane Reade, we have Starbucks, we have Supercuts, we have Barnes & Noble.
Yeah.
That's not the New York that you're describing of that kind of immigrant power. But that immigrant power turned on the city having very progressive laws to control the rich landlords. And we've lost those laws. Malafi, Italian immigrant, Zico, Egyptian immigrant, maintain their dream of that restaurant across the street from here. Well, they're up against a major challenge. And that Gus, a Greek immigrant who ran a neighborhood restaurant for 23 years that my daughter grew up in, is now bankrupted. And what are they going to put there? They're going to put one of those chain video stores. You know, so the New York City that you're talking about has actually been really undermined. And see, this is how Bush works, the way, the you know, what Rawls calls oligarchic interests, and I would just say, you know, unregulated capitalist interest of the rich landlords is that they make money by putting small business out of work. And this is the kind of thing that the small businessman who might read Bush and say, oh my goodness, we're going to get tax cuts as small businessmen. Well, you're not going to, your tiny little tax cut isn't going to matter. It's what's going to matter is the fact that you can't pay your rent in New York City because the landlords control the city. So in that way, I think one of the things that we have to do in New York is really make New Yorkers, and just on the level of city, make New Yorkers aware, including immigrants and non-immigrants, that we always cherished this city that made possible many different people coming in and bringing in their cultural difference and their ethnic difference and making it a reality into some kind of store. We're losing that. And this is part of the, you know, who doesn't get regulated? Capitalists. But everybody else gets regulated in the Bush administration. The super rich, they can do whatever they want. All the rest of us, we're going to be regulated at the level of our rights, and we're going to have to face rents that are just insurmountable.
Okay, that's really another dimension.
And that, see, that allows, hopefully, you know, that you know, famous petty bourgeoisie who can be right-wing to see that their interests are not against the working class interests or against those who are for the public schools. In a sense, we're all fighting right now to keep fundamental access to our city available to all of us, and the fight for public schools and the fight to get back rent control so that you can have security that your rent won't be changed overnight, you know, doubled, tripled, quadrupled. As happened to Gus. People sit outside that restaurant and cried. It's right down the street from here on Waverly Place. And so there's a deep way, and you see, this is the big lie politics of the Bush administration. It is a defense of the wealthy control this country with no regulation. And the rest of us have to submit to what that's going to mean for our public institutions, for our chance to realize even the dream of being a small businessman. But it doesn't get put that way, of course.
The gender hierarchies, they are probably part of how you define the imaginary domain. And is that a kind of domain where you have this as an example for the problems probably and the difficulties in working this out, this field of negotiation and community, because if we really consider on what gender hierarchies are, then we must we can always see that the other is not really the one who is considering his privileges as being a man, being on the other side, being a male, probably with privileges which a woman still not have. So, would you say there can be this can be this should be a kind of example, this gender hierarchy as an imaginary domain to change probably situations Well, yes,
figure
and
out
you see
what is the problem in communities or in a society which has this kind of
gender
double
harm.
Structure?
The imaginary domain is meant to be a law, and as a law, it's meant to be universalizable. So in a sense, there, at the level of the articulation of the ideal, it doesn't recognize the existence of hierarchy. I mean, it's not meant to be tailored, since it's an ideal, to what is. However, if you demand for women the right to their imaginary domain, and the right to articulate who and how they live with their sexual difference, that's going to mean all sorts of things that are going to break down the gender hierarchy.
Yeah.
And this, for me, was a way of trying to deal with the endless debates about essentialism,
yeah.
you know, and the danger of reinscribing actual gender hierarchies whenever you try to define any law based on gender as you now imagine it actually is. So what I wanted to say, for instance, the right to abortion, you know, the right to abortion under the imaginary domain is that each human being needs to imagine that they have bodily coherence, men and women. Now, men don't get pregnant, so, you know, they don't have that particular imaginary struggle, but we do. But men have their imaginary struggles, and we have ours. We have to be given the right to be able to imagine our bodies and our uteruses as part of who we are, and not the state taking over our uterus. So in that way, if you think about it, the imaginary domain, just granting women the right to the imaginary domain means the right to abortion. And it means the right to abortion.
Yeah. And is this a veil of ignorance from Rawls? Do you think there's a connection to this imaginary domain?
No.
That it has the same status?
It can have the same status. That's right. It could have the same status. It could serve actually at the level of a hypothetical experiment of the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
It also can function as what I'm calling an actual aesthetic idea.
Yeah.
And the way I argued in my first book, The Imaginary Domain, to use the phrase, is that you could see how if you were behind the veil of ignorance, you would want the ideal of the imaginary domain.
Yeah.
So you could actually use the veil of ignorance as a way of imagining why you would imagine that you would need this ideal. Another way of thinking about the imaginary domain is exactly your way, and some South African writers have used it this way. The imaginary domain is actually the aesthetic place where negotiations and reconciliation take place.
Yeah.
And that it's therefore more fruitful to think about, you know, how we imagine an ethnic reconciliation in South Africa, to think of it as something that we negotiate in idealized conditions for the imaginary domain, as opposed to the veil of ignorance. So they've actually defended it at that level. And I think you could go many different ways with this. You also, and the way Derrida himself always preferred to think of it as the imaginary domain, was this materialization through attempt to negotiate the problems of identity, what I've called identity, identification, and position, and not come up with a simple anti-identity politics, or old-fashioned affirmation, you know, of some kind of blood-based identity politics. And so I think Derrida preferred to think of the imaginary domain much more as a space, you know, in which we actually try to negotiate a different kind of politics around these complex relationships between identity, identification, and position.
Yeah. And to come probably to another point, because you said you were as a multicultural family, which is really normal here in New York, to be a multicultural family in South Africa. And what was your experience being there as a multicultural family? And has this, how you live with this kind of multiculturality, has this something, is there a connection to how we can fill the imaginary domain?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you know, see, I think what happens when you're in a multicultural family in the United States or in South Africa is you're always confronted with all the many imaginaries that dominate what we think of as racialization and colorization of human beings. And so, in a sense, it's making you confront the imaginaries of others. and you begin to see how imaginary race is at the same time, but it's only too real. So I think living in a multicultural family, interestingly enough, is one of the things that prompted me to think that there's a difference between identity, identification, and position. And you know, I am white in my position, and my daughter is not. And this means things like, if my daughter is with a very dear friend of mine, we're going to the movies with tonight, who's black, she and my daughter can't get a taxi. Add me to the picture, and the three of us will be able to get into a taxi. And that's when I started to see, you know, the position that I'm in is that different at that moment. And if Lucy and Crystal, her daughter, her friends, were going to the movies with tonight, try to get a taxi, they won't. They will not be picked up.
In New York?
In New York. I have to get the taxis for them. Those taxi drivers don't want to pick up even a black mother with her black daughter. Now, Mervyn, her son, who's black and who was in South Africa with me, brings out these palpable imaginaries.
Yeah.
And I will give a funny story. I was sitting on a bench with him. He's my daughter's math tutor, discussing in the park. And he was going over, you know, how she'd been progressing. And a professor friend of mine thought maybe I was in trouble and came up and said, Priscilla, are you okay? And I was like, you know, so stunned. I didn't know what he was talking about. And I said, yeah, what do you mean, Mike? Okay, I'm just talking to my daughter's math teacher. And he said, that's your daughter's math teacher, tutor? So there you get all of this. Drusilla sitting too close to a black man, maybe he's threatening her. What? That's that black man with the do-rag is a math tutor? They do math? I didn't know. You know, I mean, all of this racism is just consolidated in that little incident. And then again, I started to see I could never be in Mervyn Bryant's shoes. Mm-hmm. You know, as a black man, he's living with systematic racism day in and day out that I can't even imagine. But because I'm with him, it's now in my face, too. And so you might say I was called to begin to negotiate and say, you know, well, the critiques of identity politics are way too simple because I am positioned in white skin privilege. Let's use an old-fashioned pronoun phrase. And he's on some other side, some other whole materialized existence where he has to bear that all the time. And you know, it has to do with the way police treat you. It's just being a black man in this society is a nightmare. Now, I have access to that it's a nightmare. And so I think what it made me do, in a sense, is you might say that the idea of the imaginary domain came to me in part because of how people need to be able to come to terms with that in their own way. And it's easy for us to say, well, you know, we can put words or images into circulation, like the N-word that I certainly would never pronounce. But who are we, meaning white people, to put it into circulation? I mean, you know, so I became very aware that the need, for instance, to affirm your identity as a black man may be something that you need the space to do in your own way. And it's not for me to tell you, you know, how to come to terms with what that means.
Yeah.
And the imaginary domain in that way is kind of a humble idea. So it all came out. And my daughter's endurance of racism that I couldn't imagine. And me not being able to braid her hair. Just all these little, these day-to-day things we go through in a multicultural family made me very aware of the need for the imaginary domain and how hard it is for people to come to terms, particularly white people. That they may not identify as white. I certainly don't. But we don't just get to say, oh, I don't identify as white, and leap out of our whiteness as long as we live under institutional racism. So, and in South Africa, because there's so much attention to race, a multicultural family sticks out. But the difference of South Africa and here is everybody's going to ask you about it. You know, I mean, and so the race is verbalized. Struggle around race is verbalized. There's a lot more in-your-face contest about race than there is in the United States.
You have to say.
But Mervyn was very struck by, you know, that a waitress that's a very good friend of ours would just refuse to speak Afrikaans to a customer. You know, it's just like, I won't speak your language, you know, because Afrikaans is the language of the oppressor. Speak to me in English or I won't get you a cup of coffee. He has been so used, by many black men, is that you just have to endure a certain amount of this racism because there's no, you know, palpable struggle about it.
Yeah.
And if you try to struggle about it as an individual black man, you may end up in deep shit, if you'll forgive my language. So there's a politicization of race that he found very freeing.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, because it's right there. And people are going to call you on it, talk to you about it, maybe get a little contentious about it. I think we had that much more at the time of the civil rights movement. Mm. You know, that racist jokes weren't okay. What got called politically correct?
Mm-hmm.
And people would confront each other much more about that type of thing. Mm. Now it's been buried again.
Yeah.
Ja, das war das Gespräch mit Drusilla Cornell. Und weitere Veröffentlichungen von Drusilla Cornell sind zum Beispiel At the Heart of Freedom, Feminism, Sex and Equality, Declaring Our Freedom, Feminist Rethinking Sex and Equality, The Imaginary Domain, Abortion, Pornography and Sexual Harassment, Feminist Contentions, A Philosophical Exchange, Transformations, Recollective Imagination and Sexual Difference. Deutsche Veröffentlichungen sind zum Beispiel Versuchung der Pornografie oder der Streit um die Differenz mit Nancy Fraser, Sheila Benabib und Judith Butler. Am Mikrofon verabschiedet sich jetzt Felicia Herrschaft. Hier im Hintergrund Zydeco, Wilfred Chavez and the Texas Band aus dem Big Easy. Mikrofon verabschiedet sich Felicia Herrschaft. Zydeco, Boogaloo. Thank you.
you learn. One can't teach.